Hey friends, are you enjoying this episode and are excited for more content to come? Consider becoming part of the Hayden Behind the Music Stand family on Patreon. Any contribution level helps keep the podcast alive. That's at patreon.com/HaydenMusicStand. Other ways to support are to recommend episodes to friends and family and to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. It's quick, easy, and a free way to spread the word about my fantastic guests and all the incredible accomplishments they achieve in the music world. Also, feel free to reach out to us through social media at Hayden Music Stand and by email haydenmusicstand@gmail.com. Thanks, and enjoy the episode. Hot dog, and welcome to Hayden Behind the Music Stand. I'm your host, Patty Ryan, and with me is James Jaffe, who is a cellist based in the San Francisco Bay Area and co-founder of Wave Chamber Collective. He is the artistic director of Festival Roland, performs frequently through the Group Muse platform, is a core member of One Found Sound, the cellist of the Sierra Quartet, appears frequently at Trinity Alps Chamber Music Festival, and coaches chamber music at the Crowden School. And we'll be talking about hiking and backpacking. Welcome, James. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Patty. It's good to see you again, too.
Yeah, it's been too long. We officially met at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music when you were starting your artistic certificate, right? Not a master's, or which one was it?
Yes, yeah, exactly. Artist certificate. And I think you had been there for a year, and I was like maybe like an incoming new guy or something, like the following year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the chamber music program there we were doing, which is sort of this unique program where select students are able to perform with the likes of Menachem Pressler, the late Jeff Nuttall, and other greats that came through that program and spent some time with us. And I guess I just happened to mention Jeff Nuttall because I think both of us performed a Haydn quartet with him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for those, most of our community knows this, but Jeff Nuttall was the first violinist of the St. Louis String Quartet, and he recently, back in November, passed away from pancreatic cancer, which was very, very sad. He was, of course.
He's been top of mind for me, too. I was at his memorial concert, which was like, I don't know if you probably, through our network, have heard about it, but it was just like a real coming together of like a whole bunch of chamber music people, and it was inspiring, actually, to see. inspiring to see the people he's inspired. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, totally. I mean, when you watch him perform, it's also, I just remember as well his passion specifically for Haydn, I've never met anyone that
like, there was a moment I remember when he was giving a masterclass, and he was also like, he would like light up a whole room, you know, when he was coaching, but he said, I remember my group was playing on stage and then we were playing a Beethoven quartet and he got so excited, he's like, no, look what he's doing, this Beethoven, he was pretty good. I mean, he was no Haydn, but he was pretty good. And he was like, and this is why, and he was like,
yeah, that's funny.
So he really staked that out, you know, a position of like, yeah, Haydn.
Absolutely. And also, just fun fact for some people, my colleagues in the Artaria String Quartet, the two founding members are violinists, competed at Banff with the St. Lawrence when they won the Banff competition.
No way. So that's cool.
Yeah, so there's like this generational sort of connection. So anyway, I didn't mean to go on a huge tangent on Jeff Nuttall, but he's just such a force in the chamber music world, and or was a force, and a tree has fallen. But anyway, we met in San Francisco, we met at the conservatory. We got to know each other. I knew you a little bit through the past quartet that you were competing with as well at Cleveland Institute, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, just naturally we became friends and that's how we know each other.
Yeah, totally.
So can you share with me your most insane performance or audition story?
Sure. Well, just because we're talking about that time, you know, in San Francisco, I really showed up in San Francisco at pretty much the last minute. So around that time of you knowing that quartet I was part of, kind of the last thing that we got to do together was the Robert Mann seminar in January in Manhattan. And then we already knew at that point that we're going to go our separate ways. And so I, with like 10 days notice, applied to San Francisco Conservatory. And it was that thing you've already said. It's like one of these unique places in the country where you can only study chamber music. So that's just setting the scene for me, like showing up in San Francisco, and it's different. I was a kid. I grew up here in the Bay Area, but I'd never tried living in San Francisco. And the music scene here is, it's unique. It's unusual. So this crazy performance story is during my first semester, through some friends I had made at Classical Revolution, I got a message that a heavy metal band was going to need a cellist to be in full costume and makeup to be a demented cello playing clown.
Right. That's totally, yeah, you get that knock on your door every single day, right?
You'll get those kind of gigs here. And if you go to Classical Rep. And so I go down to Oakland on like the kind of flats, like those warehouses down by the bay, and I'm hearing metal music coming out of a warehouse. And so I bang on the door. You can't just knock to be heard. And then the door opens and this guy, he's all tatted up and he's full, just clearly in a metal band, and he's holding a guitar. And I go, oh, sweet. Is this? Yeah, they asked for a cellist, like to be a clown. Like, I didn't know how to even like explain like what I'm doing there,
right?
And he goes like, oh, hold on. And he goes in the back and he like talks to his guys, and he's like, I hear him shouting like, hey, shut up guys. And he goes, did anyone order a clown? And like, did anyone like order like a cello clown? He's like, I had to check, someone might have. And he comes back, no, that's not us. You probably want Machine Head, they're in like the next warehouse. I'd like interrupted like the wrong metal band's rehearsal. Yeah, and then I went, and then it really was the right place in the next warehouse, and it was this band called Machine Head. I think the song's called And Now We Die. I feel like I'm probably in it for like, I don't know, 6 frames total. Like, it's just so quick.
Was it a music video?
Yeah, it was a music video. I had not recorded. They said, oh yeah, we had some other guy play on the recording. So I was just like syncing to the recording.
Oh, so you're just a face.
Yeah. Like, I'm just, but in full, like, clown makeup. Like, a clown suit, white face with, like, black, you know, highlights or whatever. Yeah.
Eyeliner. Yeah.
Eyeliner. The scene they were shooting before me, they were, like, frustrated because they were trying to get fake plastic bones to fall through frame properly.
Oh.
Like, they kept missing they were, like, trying to have falling bones, like, obviously. And, yeah. and they kept missing the frame with the bones. And, yeah, but it was really funny. And then I got back, and then I had SFCM orchestra rehearsal, like, right after. So I, like, sit down in orchestra, like, and I hadn't had time to wash off all of this, like, white paint that's on my face. But that was fun.
Wow, what a weird story. Do you get royalties from that at all, or?
Oh, man. So, yeah, if anyone can get in touch with Machine Head and tell them I want, you know, a cheeseburger.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. Are you ready for some Spitfire questions?
Sure. Go for it. Okay.
Robert Schumann or Johannes Brahms?
Oh, Brahms.
Tchaikovsky or Stravinsky?
Interesting. Ah, I love them both. That's a really hard one. But if I already picked Brahms, then I already put myself on a certain area of the Brahms and Tchaikovsky divide. And so then we now got to go to Stravinsky.
Oh, I see. I see how you're... Okay.
You know how Russians think of Tchaikovsky like a lot of like other Europeans think of Brahms? Because they are sort of parallel in time frame, you know? Like they had nearly the same birthday, 7 years apart or something like that.
Is that true? And I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, and a lot of people seem to love one or the other, but not both. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I kind of do, but, well, but yeah, anyway.
You can like whoever you like is what I say to that.
Well said, yeah.
Chocolate or vanilla?
Chocolate.
Apples or oranges?
Oranges.
I have a theory, by the way. Can I just share this and spoil it for all the audience?
Go.
I have a theory that, thank you. I have a theory that if you lived in California, you pick oranges.
Okay.
And if you've lived anywhere else, you pick apples. And I'm curious to see in the future how that's going to follow suit for other guests that come on. Because that seems to be what I'm noticing.
Love that. Also,
oranges are so much better in California. That's why. Like, if you go and, I mean, like, oranges here in Minnesota are fine. But they're not California oranges. You know what I mean? Yeah.
I can add even more depth now to your theory. Because I grew up in California, but then I lived in Ohio for, like, a couple years as a kindergartner. And I feel like I liked apples more at that point.
Yes. And I totally see, that's the other side of it, is that now I eat more apples in Minnesota because the apples here are incredible.
Yeah.
They're so good. So
we have to,
like,
get it. I feel like in California, we get the good ones are in Washington State and they have to come down here.
Right. Or they're probably shipped from Wisconsin or Minnesota.
Or maybe they're, you guys are sending them. Yeah.
Yeah. Who knows? Yeah. But probably Washington. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm sorry. I totally, it's supposed to be Spitfire. Favorite zoo animal to see?
Oh, man. I want to say zebra, and then I realize I've never seen one in a zoo, so I'm going penguin. I like,
really?
I'm like,
you never seen a zebra?
I'm spitfiring too fast here. But obviously, penguin. Well, had, I knew it was black and white something.
I mean, I think it's funny to me that you say, well, obviously penguin, because that's mine too. But
oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. But it's like, well, yeah, I'm like, obviously penguin.
That's great.
Fan favorite question. Favorite concerto for any instrument or instruments in any genre?
Oh, Brahms Double Concerto.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Have you played it before?
Yeah, in high school.
Oh, what? How? That's nice.
I mean, I'm not saying I played it well, but...
No, well, at least you got... I've never had the opportunity to play that piece, and it's a crazy, awesome piece.
Oh, man, yeah. I think, I mean, sometimes we cellists get bummed out that Brahms didn't write us a concerto, but he really did. Like, that piece is so juicy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last show you recommended to a friend?
That I was in or no?
I mean, you tell me.
Okay, well, the honest answer is I have been recommending this show I played on Monday night a lot to people because it's just these wave shows are fun. There's always some chamber music as the baseline, and then there's always like a tie-in with another art form. So like lectures by scientists or pottery by a local potter or, you know, poetry.
These concerts are through Wave Chamber Collective?
Mm-hmm. I also took Mary to the ballet not long ago, and that was really fun. I mean, this is now the girl I'm engaged to, but it's my first time dating a non-musician, and she loved it. But we had so much fun, but it was just like, that was a great show. And I would recommend anybody, if you're able to make it to San Francisco soon while they're still doing this thing at the ballet, it's really cool. Because it's like it's just not old war horses. It's like three brand new short ballet. Actually, I think there's 9 of them total, but there's 3 per program. And,
okay. Yeah. All right, anyway. So that's SF Ballet. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice. Okay. Favorite Disney hero or heroine and villain?
Ooh, Scar. I even went for the villain first.
You know, you're not alone there. I think that's usually a common one to go. Like, I think that's the one that sticks out the most.
Yeah.
The antagonist. Yeah.
Yeah. I have happy childhood memories. I think Snow White was a fun one. She was a very early one too, but yeah, she was cool.
Worst travel story.
Early on, Mary and I dating, we went backpacking in Zion, and we came out of that, and the airport we were flying out of was Vegas, and we had so much time to make this flight, which kind of makes it extra funny. And then Mary was like, I really want a coffee. Can we like stop at Starbucks first and then go to the airport? And then from that Starbucks to the airport was nearly impossible because it was still mid-pandemic, and so they were just like really hard to get an Uber or Lyft or anything. They all would like say, yeah, totally, we're sending a driver, and then you keep looking at your app and it's like no, we're not, and nobody's here, and we lied to you.
Yeah.
And so I had to talk this driver who I saw standing next to his cab, like it was like a normal real cab company, and mm-hmm. he was on his break or something, and I was like, will you please drive us to the airport, like we're gonna miss it. And then we get there, and it's like, I think our airline, whichever airline it was, they all suck, was like, you need to be here checked in 45 minutes before to get your baggage. And we were there within like 43 minutes or something.
Yeah,
like, so,
right.
So we all of our baggage that we're going to check suddenly had to become carry-on. And we're like, all right, we'll just take it with us. We'll try and put it on carry-on. We like rushed through security and TSA, there's no line. So I was like, oh, sweet. But then the guy wanted to have this conversation with me about my backpacking gear and was like, oh my God, I have the same water filter. Like, and then like, and I'm like sitting there like, you cannot be there like tapping your like thing at TSA and just be like, I have
to get
on this.
Dude, I gotta go.
Yeah, like, yeah. Like, and then it was like, of course, like a stupid thing if you have to like get on that air train thing and go to another terminal. And we finally get there. We are like running with like all our gear and just like sweating. And like they have closed, like they have fully closed the gate door. And there's like a crowd of people like trying to talk to this gate agent. And they're like, we're sorry, the door is closed. You weren't here soon enough. Like, you're not making this flight. And we were just like there, like kind of waiting and trying to talk to the agent. And then all of a sudden we see people walking through the jetway. I guess it was a jetway with like a transparent side or something.
Yeah.
And then these people are walking off, and then the gate door opens, and it's these people who apparently were anti-maskers and like refused to wear masks on the flight. So in this like weird, but then once the gate door had reopened, our agent at the gate called the plane and said, well, the door's already open again, like, can I just let on these people, like, you haven't filled their seats. And then the people on the plane were like, okay, fine, send them on. And we made our flight.
Oh my God, that's Oh my gosh. That I just feel a lot of pent up, because I have my own like crazy travel story, which
Oh my god. Well, can you tell me? I know you're the host, but I want to hear.
And like, sure, I'll try to tell you the Reader's Digest version of it, but my story did not go as well as yours. And that's where I'm just like, I wish I had, like, I know that's crazy. Mine is kind of similar. It was for my sister's wedding too. And I like know the airports, this Minneapolis St. Paul Airport. It's Terminal 2. Terminal 2 is very small. In the past, TSA was a breeze. Like, and so I had plenty of time in certain ways, but like naturally on my clock, I'm always a little bit late. So I was like, oh, okay. I left like 5-ish minutes later than I wanted to. And I was driving myself to park at the airport to then go. So there's no other like transit thing. So I drove, but when I was driving there, I got stuck behind what ended up being this long, long, like 100+ car trail following a hearse.
Oh.
Yeah. So I was like part of this parade and eventually I was able to get around it. And so then I got to the airport parking, and again, in my experience, it's been available, like tons of spots available. I was circling around trying to find parking for 5 minutes, got lucky because someone left, so I took their spot. Then I went to TSA and saw a line as long as I've ever seen it. It was going up the ramp towards parking where I had come from.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and like...
Yeah, talk about like stories that are like, I can feel, I'm feeling yeah. it. Like,
Yeah. And like, it's a Thursday afternoon, like, you know, yeah. like in December, like before Christmas, yeah. you know? And so like, I got there and I was like, can someone please help me? I'm probably gonna miss my flight. And like, there's like those security people that are supposed to facilitate the security gate and like, you know, the getting through TSA and things like that. And one of them was like, you're supposed to show up 2 hours before your flight because you know, in instances like this. And it's like, I don't know, it's just like, well, that's not the situation right now. Like the situation is I'm gonna miss my flight. And again, long story short, I ended up missing my flight. I had to sit in that entire line zigzagging, and I got through security, grabbed my shoes, my laptop, and I just ran barefoot to the gate, which of course was like all the way on the other side. It wasn't like the one front of security. And like at that point they had closed the doors, and like I was
wearing
a mask too. Yeah,
of course. Yeah, it's like so you made it, because that's the end of my story is really that we made our flight but for like the wrong reasons or something, like because like the only reason we made it is literally like people refusing to mask up. And this is like,
right,
I don't even know if there was a vaccine at this point. I mean, it was like a real like bold time to be an anti-masker, we could say.
Yeah.
You know, like it was yeah. like, okay, you're really an anti-masker at this point. Like,
yeah,
that was the only reason we made it. So it was, otherwise it would have turned out the same.
Yeah. But yeah. It's also like just these weird series of events, like you getting, you know, wanting to stop by and getting some Starbucks.
Oh, before, I know.
And then like how
I tried, you know, I really tried not to like bring that up later. Like,
if we only didn't. Well, yeah. I mean, that's where I kick myself. Like, if I just left like 10 minutes before, I wouldn't have gotten stuck behind this weird hearse parade or something, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Also,
yeah.
like, who died? Like, I don't know. Who's this important person?
I know,
like,
yeah.
Anyway, I'm glad we shared both of our weird travel stories that actually were similar.
Kind of parallel, yeah.
Favorite professor shout out?
Ooh. Well, I have two. I love taking with Jennifer at mm-hmm. the conservatory. That's Jennifer Culp. Also, for whatever reason, I've been thinking a lot about Bob Britton, the Alexander Technique teacher from SFCM.
Uh-huh. I remember you really into Alexander Technique a little. Yeah. Do you want to explain what it is just quickly?
Yeah, totally. Although I'll preface by saying I'm definitely not an expert. But yeah, it's like a study of, you could call it body and movement, which means that it really translates in a lot of disciplines. I do think it originated maybe with acting, but it's a very common for musicians to take. And basically, it just gives you a lot of tools to be aware of how you're using your body and then what the patterns are of use that would be most beneficial, or using the muscles to do the best job that they're supposed to be doing. A common thing that a lot of folks have is like using lots of small muscles with a bunch of tension to do something that could be used with a lot less effort using big muscles. So I had it recommended to me for years from different teachers and never got around to actually trying it until I got here to San Francisco.
Yeah, and I think that, I don't know about in your experience in the other schools that you were a part of, but for me, SFCM had like a program for Alexander Technique. Like it was right there.
That
Whereas
may be unusual.
I feel
yeah.
like in other schools, you really have to seek it out yourself. Whereas mm-hmm. like it was kind of just like this office that you could just duck into and ask him like, hey, how's my thumb look or something, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Most transformative performance experience? The clown video Radio music video. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, that, it all traces back to that, I feel like.
Yeah.
I really love when, this is kind of an odd thing to say, but I do believe there's different types of silence, and that sometimes the silence after a performance can feel so profound. I'll give you two quick examples of that. One of them I experienced myself, which was the last time before the pandemic that we got to go to France and play. We were working on Brahms' C minor piano quartet. That piece is for the Brahms fans, which I do understand isn't everybody, but if you're a Brahms person, that piece is one of the deepest dives he ever takes emotionally, I would say, in chamber music. And at the end of it, it's an interesting thing. I think most pieces end either with a kind of fade out or they end with a big fireworks. That piece is kind of neither. It's sort of like, I guess it's closer to a fade out, except then there are loud chords at the very end. And The silence after it, after we finished playing, it felt really cool. It felt like we had really like found a, we'd gotten to a place with the audience that had to do with the whole trajectory of the whole piece. And the other one was, I was not playing, I was an audience. It was the very last concert of the Tokyo Quartet. And similarly, after, that might be, if I was trying to pick favorite silences and performance out of my life, they played Debussy Quartet. And then after the third movement, the silence in there was very profound. It was like, yeah, they finished that and it's a gorgeous deep piece that you know well. But there was some, felt like, shared awareness there in the crowd that this was not only where that piece was, but then them too in their last show. It made me think that this is sort of what we're trying to do a lot of the time in music, is say those kind of things that they're literally are no words for, but also the silences around the things that we're saying are equally important, because then that's the canvas we're painting on or something.
Yeah, I was going to thank you for bringing up the fact that not every performance is about the music. And as I think what's kind of beautiful about what you're saying is that the silences after the piece or a particular moment in the music is almost the reward more than the actual piece itself.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it speaks to that journey that the performer goes on and the audience participates in and listens in, and having that shared moment of silence. I think it's something that we don't think about, or I don't know, maybe you think about it more, but I think a lot of musicians, teachers, we probably don't sit to think about what we do in the silences or how important the silences are in music.
Oh, yeah. And I claim no expertise really about it, because these times that it happened for me, I think are just like, it was so obvious or something, or it was right in my face what was happening. And I was like, Oh, wow. You know, so I think It was just showing itself to me or something. But
well, maybe that's it too.
But yeah. Yeah, that was well said. Yeah, you put it. Yeah.
Alternate universe musical instrument.
Ooh, I've always liked the clarinet, actually. Bass clarinet, maybe? Although, I don't know. Does anyone only specialize in bass clarinet? Maybe not.
Maybe like third clarinet in a symphony or something. a band.
Yeah.
Professional.
Oh, yeah.
Army
a professional. Yeah. Okay, good. That's it. Perfect. Bass clarinet.
Is it because of the end
band? Bass clarinet in the army band. Yeah. Maybe not this army, even.
Yeah, any, yeah. Or
yeah. Maybe, who, I don't know who's hiring, yeah. Does Canada have an army?
I think they'd be pretty peaceful. Well, you finished the Spitfire questions. Congratulations. All right, James, can you walk me through your musical origin story? How did you discover classical music, the cello? When did you decide that you wanted to take that professionally? And walk me through the steps to where you are in your career today.
Yeah, sure. So I'm a bit of an unusual case in that both of my parents are in classical music. So my mom is a musicologist. She wrote a lot about Brahms, actually, and his relationship with his teacher. But also, just as a music listener, I got something from her. She's the kind of musicologist where it's like she comes to it because she loves the music, like she like wants to write about it and make it clear to other people because of how it makes her feel. And then my dad's a conductor. He conducts a couple regional orchestras out here in California. So it's like, I really don't remember a time of music not being around. There's a story I don't really remember personally that well, but I think I was listening to my dad rehearse. He's moved around for having some different conducting jobs. So this was when he was conducting at Pomona College down in by LA, which is where I was born. born, and I think it was like Dvorak's Serenade for Strings that he was rehearsing like with the college orchestra, and like I threw a tantrum as a little kid in the audience because of my mom needing to take me home. Like I didn't want to go. So I guess there was something about like the music that was just a great thing. I did not feel pressured to go into it as a career. Like it was there very much in the background. And I think my parents did in some way want everything that they knew about music to somehow get maybe passed down. But I have two brothers also, and we all started music instruments as kids, but then ended up going different directions, and I'm the only one who decided to go professional with it. There was a time, I think in sixth grade, where I told my dad I wanted to go into music, and he either gave me a talk of almost talking me out of it, or more likely it was just a talk of like, this is going to be really hard.
Yeah.
Because he knew from doing it himself, and it's going to be competitive, or it's not going to be kind of like other jobs. But I'm in sixth grade, and all I knew was that I liked doing music. So that didn't affect me in the same way. I was like, okay, well, I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah. Like you weren't thinking about a retirement plan, or you were thinking about buying a house.
Right, yeah. I'm not like, you know, well, home ownership. So yeah, that was sort of like the background, I think.
Why cello?
Oh my God. My grandfather picked up this cello that I now play in St. Louis in the 50s. He was kind of like lived and worked there for a couple years on his way from New York to the West Coast. He was a chemical engineer, but he really made that choice to be a chemical engineer, I think, to make sure and be able to support his family. And he really loved playing music. But he was part of that folk music revival thing that was going on in New York in the 40s. You know, he had a guitar that was Woody Guthrie's and stuff. And it was like in his 30s, heard Bach cello suites on the radio and decided he wanted to try doing that. So he picked up this cello. Yeah, right, exactly. And my grandma would complain about how he sounded when he was practicing, you know.
Fairly, I can't imagine.
the phrase, you sound like you're killing cats, may have come up.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's how that cello ended up. And so that cello was like sitting under the piano in my grandparents' house, unplayed. And I think my grandma was, at the same time that I was sort of like discovering that I liked the sound of the cello, my grandma was there in the background being like, yeah, you should play cello. Or maybe it was one, I don't know what order things happened, but she was a wise grandma, I think, and like wanted to nudge me towards playing cello. But yeah, that's kind of how it got started. And, you know, in a way that like some dads might be playing catch with their kid or something, like my dad would be like asking me key signatures. Like,
gotcha.
You know, it was sort of like, it was teaching me, and I learned a lot of stuff early on from him, but it was also kind of like a bonding thing too. It was cool. And yeah, so I kind of, even before formally starting cello lessons, there was just this kind of background of like, okay, well, you know, here's the stuff about music. And I started off in a youth orchestra in Stockton. That's where I like grew up, you know, in the Valley in California. A couple years after that, when I was looking for something like a little higher level, I went to the Sacramento Youth Symphony. And then a couple years later, my last couple years of high school, I ended up playing in San Francisco Youth Orchestra. I still have friends actually from all of those periods. And I literally said this sentence to somebody that I was carpooling back from a gig with the other day, which is that like I would have quit music, I'm sure, at some point if I didn't have friends doing it too, like friends going through it too.
I think that's a huge reason why people go professional, because I mean, at least in the testimonies I've heard over the years of doing this podcast, it's like always about where their friends were is why they kept doing it. And then like wanting to be in the same orchestras with their friends who are advancing, like, oh, well, I want to. It's interesting how like it's that community that really keeps us. For some people, it's the community that keeps us wanting to get better at our instrument.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And also, I think for a lot of folks, there are work friends and then there are personal friends. And I think for us, it's frequently a lot more blended together, just because what we're doing for work, you really, really, really have to take your full self into a lot of the time. And then having these friends who know your full self like that makes them more than just work friends, I think.
Right. That's a good way of putting it.
So anyway, a lot of friends from these times. I got some cool, actually in high school, speaking of Jeff Nuttall, that was like, I got to do a pilot version of this Music at Menlo program, which was just really getting off the ground then. And they were, so I was maybe a guinea pig or something for that. And people like the St. Lawrence Quartet and, you know, Dave Finkel, Wuhan were there. And like, the other thing about, I would say right up there with having friends doing it is having mentors, like having people who are the next generation up. You're seeing that they really stuck at it and made it their life, and that that's a thing you can do in the face of the rest of a society, which is often going to tell you that being an artist is impractical.
Yeah.
So it's very important, I think, for a musician to have those moments of mentorship. And I think it's also, maybe you and I have both seen, I'm just going to take a guess, that like having now done some teaching and mentoring ourselves, maybe, I don't think we as kids realized that we were doing something for the older teachers just by being that into it.
Yeah.
But the fact that I was just such a dork about chamber music all along, you know,
yeah.
I feel like in a lot of areas that's unwelcome or something. Or that's not, if not unwelcome, it's just odd.
Maybe, yeah. Nerdy. Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. But contrast that with like to those people who really have become teachers and professors and made their life about it, they would be excited to see like a young person
discovering the repertoire for the first time. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, those early music festivals, Music of Menlo, I went to Aspen and had some of those type experiences and got a feel for like music schools where I thought I loved the culture. Like there was something for me about CIM kids and NEC kids where I wasn't going to any of those schools yet, but they seemed to have this fun combination of like being good at what they did and also kind of not being fun also, or being like personable. So yeah, those were the places that were on my mind like when I thought about trying out for undergrad. My path was a very odd. I never auditioned at Michigan, which is where I ended up until really late in the game. I was gonna send my acceptance to Juilliard. It was like, okay, sweet, I got in. I guess that's what you're supposed to do. Like,
yeah.
But that was in conflict with another thing that I'd been taught, which is that you want to find the teacher that's gonna like hopefully help you the most. So those two things were a little in conflict because I suddenly got this message from a teacher who was moving to Michigan at the time, and I was like, oh man, like he's great with technique. Hopefully he'll like fix this thing where my shoulders are like up in my ears the whole time when I'm trying to play a concerto or something. Like I did not have super solid technical teaching as a high schooler. I had a lot of Bay Area kind of, you want to picture a butterfly in a field.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
And I'm like, and it's like,
there's a time and place for that though.
There is, you know, like, why do we beat our brains out over technique if not to try and capture something that lovely? But then on the flip side of it, like needing to take care of the details of how to make something happen on your instrument, it helps people suspend their disbelief. It helps people like put them at ease that like someone's taking care of that. And it's the audience who can relax and have that, you know, transformational experience. So I ended up in Michigan with very little notice for undergrad and loved it. It was the only place I tried out that wasn't like a conservatory. And I think going to a big state school was like really different. And I tried to just lean into it. Like I was like, all right, I'm going to get like football season tickets and go to the games and I'm going to do like the big school thing. So that was great. I think the through line for me was always chamber music. Like it was always the thing that I was most trying to focus on. So I got to do quartets while I was there. I got to do trios while I was there. Andy Jennings was on the faculty there. I remember him as a chamber coach.
Of the Concord String Quartet.
Mm-hmm. It was a good experience. But looking for somewhere that had something really more focused on chamber music led me to CIM. I feel lucky to have been there while Peter Soloff still was, because a lot of people can at some point to like chamber coaches were kind of like a luminary or who really like were like the center of gravity of a chamber music program. And he was that. It took a few coachings for some students to like grasp what was going on, because his style was so warm and calm that students would get stressed out if he wasn't giving them like a ton of feedback immediately. Mm. He was the kind of teacher who taught with his presence, and like it was cool to watch him just sit in the group for a second. He would like we'd even laugh about it later, because he would like be like unpacking his violin case and it would be so zen and loving, and then he would like take the blanket off his violin and then he would take the bow out of the case, and then he would get in, and he would get next to you, and he was okay. And we're all just sitting there like, we're 20, like what is happening?
Meanwhile, like other teachers like myself, I just like rip my cello out of the case and let me sit down, don't even take the end pin out. Like
Right. Which is important and profound. I feel like it's just like teachers are the best ones anyway, just true to themselves, whatever that is.
This is true.
But that was him. And then he would give you a cue, and I swear it would be like a download of like terabytes of information. Like just watching him cue into like a thing, and you're like, and you're like heart, and it's just like, oh.
Like, you totally get it, right? Like, it's
Yeah, and it was just like, okay, there really was something to all this, like, crazy Cleveland Quartet voodoo, whatever it was. Like, so I love that. Also, I was just thinking about it. I was like, we had something similar to that big chamber music class that happens in San Francisco, but it was just six quartets picked for it. It was like an intensive quartet seminar. And like, there's so many great quartet sets of six. Like, there's, I think a lot of the Haydn sets are, there's like the Mozart Haydn quartets, and then there's like Beethoven Opus 18s and the Bartoks. And like, that was a really memorable semester when like this seminar and like six groups each working on a Bartok quartet. It was just a vibe. It was like a thing that I aspire to if I'm in a position to create it, which is like a chamber music class that's just so supportive. Like, and music schools can be stressful, competitive places. I think that's kind of the nature of the beast sometimes. And so it felt really special that, I think it's also because like Bartok quartets are so freaking hard.
Oh,
so it's
God,
like,
you're telling me.
So it's like, you're just kind of like, we're in this together. You're seeing your friends on stage, like tackle something that's equally hard to what your group is trying to tackle. And then it's just cool, like hearing all of the quartets played every week. Yeah. So I really am thankful that I ended up in Cleveland, like for some of my sort of chamber music training.
So you wrapped up at CIM and then you kind of told the story about this quartet that you were trying to make professional, but then the personnel didn't really quite, it just kind of fell apart a little bit. You did the Bobby Mann String Quartet Seminar, which is a prestigious thing to be a part of for the chamber music world.
Yeah. We had this summer of training where I even at the time felt like, this is unusual. This is weird. I need to just remember everything I can from this time or something. And this, to be fair, this group, when I say trying to be professional, I'm probably projecting. I think that's what I wanted. And I think other people in the group were in it for just as valid reasons of like, I want to try summer music festivals as a preformed group. Like, I feel like if you listen to this and you want to go take a preformed group to a music festival, hit the gas, you know, do it. So we went, and that was the first goal of the group, was like, let's just get some really cool training. So we went, and we went to Banff, we went to Norfolk, and we went back to Banff like after that. So it was like 11 straight weeks together in a summer. And the reason we went back is that it was a competition year. And so they used to hire like a quartet to go do this like kind of wacky tour around Alberta and like play in like bars and like gyms and farmers markets and stuff.
That's fun.
Yeah, it was fun. And the amount of people we got to meet during that time was really cool, I think, especially for like people in their early 20s. And like, I think I draw on that sort of store of like, better or worse, we're in an oral tradition or like a teacher and apprentice kind of tradition where like you can read a lot about it and you can watch a lot of YouTube videos, but ultimately like seeking out people with the knowledge is just like the way. That happened in the couple years after, you know, leaving. And so coming to San Francisco in this last minute was even almost like, should I go back to school at all? And so glad that I did. Well, I met you for one thing.
I mean, don't go to school for me.
Like, everyone listening, go to school for Patty. Yeah, even compared to Cleveland, I feel like the ability to just do a pure chamber music degree is sort of unmatched in San Francisco. And very thankful for that chamber music program and the friends I got to meet there and the folks we got to play with and all of that. But yeah, that was where I sort of did my last bit of formal training. Everything since then has been like starting groups, being part of groups, and you keep learning too. I think you, especially you work with people whose opinion you respect. That's a really cool thing in chamber music, and they'll make you better whether you like it or not.
That's true.
Yeah, so even though I always thought that my thing needed to be being part of a group, and I think maybe it'll go that direction at some point, like a group with a capital G, where it's like, this is everybody's first professional priority. Seems like I've been looking for that for a long time, but also like the way things are going now, I'm just back and forth between a lot of projects, and each one of them I feel invested in. You know, I love being part of this chamber orchestra. I love going to music festivals and stuff. So it feels like it's taking its own course, at least.
Yeah. Well, can you tell me about how you co-founded Wave Chamber Collective?
Sure.
Not this to be confused with with the group that I'm affiliated with.
Not to be confused with 10th Wave.
Yeah.
Support both.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
This was the brainchild, really, of two ladies, my longtime friend, Christina Simpson, and her longtime friend, and also now my friend, Jamila Kaba. So they were in high school together, and Jamila started something here in San Francisco called the Wave Collective. And that's just a space on Haight Street here. It's like an art gallery and hosts a whole ton of pop-up events. And then their sister collective is the Wave Chamber Collective. And this is something that Christy has been wanting to do for a long time. And she's such a, I would say, a true creative mind when it comes to designing an event that's going to feel kind of like a party, very artistic, and it's going to open the door to a ton of connections between artistic disciplines without prescribing them too heavily or without insisting that this is the part of the music that corresponds to this part of the painting. More so, right. Leaving the creating such a nice setting that the audience themselves gets to make those connections or their own connections for themselves. So that's all it is. It's like chamber music is sort of the water we swim in or something like that, or chamber music is like the hearth fire at which the rest of it can take place, which is people gathering and, you know, seeing how another art form interplays with it. And it's been fun. It's very new. It's like under a year old. We've done a few things and it's fun. Can't forget to have fun.
No, that's the whole point, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Where can people learn more about Wave Collective?
There's a website, wavechambercollective.com, and Wave Chamber Collective is on Instagram and Patreon as well.
Awesome. Yeah, there you go. Good luck with all your upcoming projects. It's awesome to see that you're still infused in the San Francisco scene. I can't wait to see where all your projects take you.
Thanks, Fatty. Awesome.
Of course. Would you like to take a break now?
Yeah, sure.
All right. We'll be right back. Welcome back from the break. So I wanted to first say that I don't know if you remember this, but early on when you first moved to San Francisco, we all went on a hike together.
Of course I remember.
You do? Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember exactly where we went, but it was like, I think we were all trying to do some, like, the students of the chamber music program, that degree program, like, we all kind of went together. So it was like, at the time, it was past guest Autumn Chodorowski, and then Meredith Kufchek, Joss Peters, and then the two of us. Mm-hmm. And I remember that being a really fun, misty day in probably Marin County or something like that.
Yeah. There was, like, some Pacific coastline and one of those staircase things that you would...
Yeah, climb up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no. So clearly you liked to hike before, as I also love hiking. But backpacking, that's got to be something new, right?
And just to stay on memory lane for a second. Yeah. Also, wasn't there a time when maybe it was just you and me and Meredith or something? And now I don't know if I'm mixing things up. We might have been in Sequoia. We might not have. But I just remember that you had a hiking burrito.
I think it was the same.
Or was that a different one?
I'm outed. It was the same hike. It was the same hike, but yes.
Oh, there's that hike.
I had got...
No, I have to say, I have copied you on this.
Oh, really?
Like, I have now gone on hikes and taken a hiking burrito because I was like, this is genius and I wish I had one.
Okay, I love Mexican food. It's like one of my like top cuisines because I grew up in San Diego. Like, how can I not love it, right? And so... Yeah. I think I must have gotten hungry and I bought a burrito and I decided to, because, you know, they wrap burritos properly in California, not like in Minnesota. Yeah. So you can like
what are they doing in Minnesota?
It's a hot mess. It gets me, even the way they fold burritos is like not even correct either, but the way they fold the tinfoil is not, so it's cylindrical.
Cylindrical, right.
It's folded like some kind of hamburger patty thing. So it's like,
it's like a Christmas present.
Yeah, exactly. Like the corners are folded in on each other. So it's like, yeah, anyway.
Okay, hot tip for all you burrito wrappers out there. The ideal way to unwrap a burrito is that you can go down and around it so that you can only expose as much burrito as you're trying to eat at that moment. Totally. Otherwise, we got total like burrito catastrophe on our
hands. Exactly. And like all the everything falls out of the burrito and all the juices fall out. Like the whole, anyway, the structure's gone. But I had forgotten about that until you just reminded me. So I'm glad that my legacy lives on with you.
Oh, yeah. I remember looking back but it wasn't like it was. Sorry, I hope I'm not throwing you under the bus. It's just like, it wasn't like quite a stop and a picnic. It was like, I was like, oh, like it's burrito time. We're like walking.
Yeah, I was mid-walking. Yeah, I think I just got hungry. I didn't want people to stop for me to eat. So I was just like, I'm just going to eat.
Of course. Yeah. But anyway, there have been burritos on other hikes inspired. Yes. Yeah. But yeah, so well, to answer the long ago question of the me and the hiking, I wasn't one of those kids whose family took him backpacking, although we went hiking and stuff. But it was after a Trinity Alps Music Festival, and a lot of them have ended. Like, the final session of the festival has ended, and then it's like whichever musicians want to stick around and go like backpacking up in the Trinity Alps can do that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And so that was my first time, which I think I pieced together not long ago with like some friends who had done it, was in summer 2015. And that was my first, like, honest to goodness, like, carrying everything on your back experience. But then, so these folks are the ones who really taught me to backpack. Like, I didn't sign up for like an REI class, or I didn't do whatever people do to learn.
Yeah.
I just like went with them. And there's a ton of stuff that's cool and different about Trinity Alps Chamber Music Festival. I mean, they're like, it was sold to me as like, you're going to go camp on a farm and everything you're going to be eating is grown there. And it's like,
that's cool,
a real like full, like very, very California thing.
Co-op-y.
Yeah. But the people who live there, they were, you know, farming, and now they've transitioned to working in fire prevention. Or actually, I think prevention is maybe an outdated word, more like prescribed fire. Like,
oh, sure.
What are the kinds of forest fires that are like properly and wisely set for maintenance, kind of a thing?
Yeah.
Point being, they're extremely aware of natural surroundings and nature, and just such incredible depth of knowledge. Like Ellen, who hosts the thing, it's like there's so many plants who she can, you know, tell you who they are and what their cousins are that you'll see at different elevations.
Oh,
and
cool.
What tea to make out of them if you're feeling a certain kind of way.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Which have a muscle relaxant property, or, you know, which are good for your respiratory system. So these are really, it was fun people to go backpacking with. It was also a very zany first backpack because of like a couple things. Like, one of the violinists had been like practicing, I think, karate kicks in the driveway and like fell and like injured his ankle. It was Peter Masek, if you ever knew him.
I don't remember.
So anyway, the point is he like rolled his ankle, and it was a really outdoorsy guy, and what really was bummed out to be missing out on the backpack because of his ankle. And so
he
ended
karate.
Up riding. Yeah. Yeah, I know. And so he ended up riding up there on a horse. Like, there was like a vet who lived across the river who had like a horse that they were like, all right, yeah, take a pack horse, which was also fortunate because then a lot of the luggage that I would have been carrying in my backpack was also able to go on the pack horse, freeing me up to take a carbon fiber cello.
Oh, you took, okay.
Yeah.
Where did you get a carbon fiber cello? Do you own one?
No. In fact, I think it was loaned by Catherine in the Del
Sol
Quartet.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
I think it was her carbon fiber cello that went up to Union Lake with us that summer in 2015.
Yeah.
And there's really some really funny pictures of like this concert that is like hilariously hard to get to that we gave, where we like told some people like, yeah, if you want to hear like Beethoven 59-2 like by the campfire, you can hike in 5 miles in camp and hear this concert.
Yeah.
And there we are, like by the campfire, playing on a carbon fiber and or beater instruments.
Yeah.
Like with like headlamps. And pretty funny about chamber music and headlamps is like normally looking at each other is like a good thing.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
But like if you're
blinding.
Wearing a headlamp, you like look up to try to give or take a cue for someone, they're like, oh god.
That's funny.
Oh yeah, so then, yes, I mean, since then there's been a couple more fun trips. It's funny, there. If you want to see premonitions in that first trip of like not just doing backpacking at the ultra light way, but doing backpacking sort of like the ultra fun way, or like the ultra like, I want to have this really bizarrely awesome experience in the woods. There's some funny things I learned like along the way, which is that like to an ultra light backpacker, the idea of like bringing in beers would be like insane. That's like so heavy. And it's not only that, if you're trying to have a drink in the woods, it's such an inefficient way to do it, because you could have whiskey or something that's like, you could pack less of it in a little bag instead of like something that's in a can.
That's true.
So I would say that I was just optimizing for different things, but there have been a couple more Trinity Alps backpacks. And then that was also the fun kinds of trips that I would take when my now fiance and I were getting to know each other. So there was that one sort of from that really crazy travel story with Zion.
Right.
And you learn little things along the way. I think, you know, there's everything about it. There's articles about it online. There's like subreddits about it. You know, there's any amount of information, but still I feel like I only learn things when actually confronted with them or something. So for instance, a good example of that is like we did this hike up to, it's called Dick's Lake. It's like in the Tahoe area, sort of part of the Sierra Range. And it was fun, but it was kind of like early spring, meaning like there's still a whole bunch of snow everywhere. And you like really bomb up like, you know, 3,000 feet climb like to get into this basin. And then it is at times like that when you think like, it would have been smarter like to think about the weight of my packet. I think that was the last trip that I took this really, really, really clever camping stove on, because it was sort of too clever for its own good. It was like a really good idea. It's a camping stove where it burns wood that you collect from around. Like you collect sticks and you put it in, and then it charges a battery using the heat of the fire. And its own battery blows a fan that makes the fire burn better. And
okay, wait, let me just get this. Wait yeah. a second. So what sparks the fire?
Me.
Is there, okay, so you have a flint or something.
Yeah, like a match or like a lighter or something, and you light it, and then it charges a battery, and then it blows a fan, and then it...
How does it charge a battery?
There's like a heat sink thing. So there's like a metal, chunky metal bit, and heating up this chunky metal bit enables it to transform heat energy into electrical energy.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, as a byproduct or something, there's a fan that it can power.
Yes.
To
exactly.
like then
not only that, it can
flame the fire.
Yeah, and it can charge your phone, and it can like run a little light, and it can do all these things. But
wow. What was the downside?
Too heavy and too smoky. But it was like a
heavy.
It's a clever product, but it was like one of those things where like the simple solution ended up winning out. Because if you have wood that's like even a little damp, or if it's just all these finicky things where it's like, oh, well, but the tiny little like butane cartridge and like that little stove thing that like a ton of people have actually is like, it's
more
easier.
Reliable.
It's more reliable. I don't know where we come down on the energy input and output of it all in terms of green. But so yeah, I think my current setup is pretty solid mid-level. I'm definitely not at the point to justify like super crazy titanium everything for...
I mean, that gets expensive quick, I bet, right?
Yeah, yeah. And also, I would say there's like you don't need a ton of that to get into backpacking. I think, you know, the basics are just having like a backpack and a water filtration system and some kind of sleeping arrangement. You want a sleeping pad, a sleeping bag. And then if temperature or precipitation is a concern, then you want a tent or bugs.
But
and
what about bears?
That's kind of it. Oh, yeah. Then as the saying goes, it's water or bears. So if you are hiking in an area with no bears, chances are you're going to have to pack in your own water. If you are hiking in an area with bears, then there's going to be nice streams to filter water out of, but you're going to want to bring a bear can. That's like a super reinforced plastic hard thing that's going to, even if a bear were to knock against it, it's going to keep your food and other stuff that smells delicious safe. But interesting thing I learned too is that Yosemite Park, for one, has really been kind of updating their bear guidance. It used to be just about like, oh, this is how to protect you from the bears. In an interesting way, the conservation around it has been changing around to like, we got to protect the bears from the humans in a certain kind of way. Because if humans are careless and leave their food out, not in a bear canister.
Yes, it's the bear's fault.
Then the bear, of course, is going to eat it. But then that bear becomes acclimated and becomes more and more and more reliant and accustomed to like getting food from humans. And then eventually down the road, that bear is going to have to be euthanized. So it's sort of like,
oh, it's sad.
Yeah, so it's like, it was a new takeaway for me, is that the bear can is just as much for the bear as it is for me.
Right. I'm just imagining like a bear having a bite of an In-N-Out burger or something and just kind of like, yeah, I can get on board with this.
Yeah.
And then like
sunglasses.
And then like, next thing he like walks up to like a little In-N-Out.
Yeah. Goes through the drive-thru.
Well, how many times have you gone backpacking since 2015?
I'm not entirely sure, but let's call it like 10.
I mean, that's a significant amount of trips, right?
Yeah, I love it. It's nice to know that you can just bring in everything you need on your back and enjoy what's there. I think especially for anybody trying to do anything creative, it's like nature is sort of our ultimate source, you know.
Inspirations,
I'm looking at your Zoom background here, and it's just like there's a really pretty painting of trees, and then there's like leaves of a vine, and it's like...
Right, I've created my own little forest here.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's not like someone told me like, hey, James, okay, listen, if you want to be in music, you should really go hike. I don't think it wasn't like so purpose driven in that way. It's just like ultimately it's kind of fun too if you end up being into it. I've been, you know, kind of interested in a whole bunch of, you know, either philosophies or practices or whatever it is. And one of the ways used to describe enlightened states is sort of like a lot of doors into the same room. So I think hiking way out in a remote area is one of the doors into the same room that other people can arrive at through like their own sports or through meditation or through yoga or even a really nice music practice, like the kind of music practice where you've like forgotten your own self and your worries, but it's like the music is there getting worked on or something. And so I think if hiking is your thing, then like going further into it, you can like stay out there for longer. But if your thing is like kind of whatever else it is, like I think it's a good way to drop a lot of those day-to-day worries that we get all tied up in.
Yeah, I really like that image of what you just said about all the doors and entry points, and I can't remember how you phrased it, but this idea that there's multiple angles of which you can look at the same field of vision or something like that.
Totally.
Yeah, and I think that that's really only something that you can in nature is where you can really examine that and see it, because oftentimes when you're walking on a hike, you have a 360 view of wherever you're standing, right? And I guess you can do the same in a city, but like, you know, there's definitely city hikes or like urban hiking. It's not quite the same, right? Yeah. Like, you know, we're still connected to humanity. We're still connected to vestiges of things that are very familiar.
Sure,
and
sure. Well, and since you said that, like another cool thing I think about hiking is that you can, all the stuff you're seeing, it all goes together, you know, like it's all an environment that you're walking in, but then all different stuff there is experiencing all these different time scales. So you're looking at rocks who got to be there as rocks on the factors of millions of years. And then you're looking at certain pine trees, like some of those really old gnarly pines that you'll get to on a hike have literally taken a couple thousand years to grow into that shape. And then some of the animals, like the big animals, might even live, you know, nearly as long as humans, or at least on a scale closer to ours. But then the little things you're seeing, they live their whole life in like a day or a couple days, like some of the bugs you're gonna see, or there's like little critters scurrying around that like they have a whole span that they're living, you know. I think that's a cool thing about it too. Yeah,
totally. And how that connects us to our own history too in a certain way, to get like super zoomed out about it as well. Yeah, I don't mean to like divert from your observations of backpacking and hiking and things like that, but I think it's something that when we get so busy on the day-to-day lifestyle, I mean, now especially coming out of a pandemic and trying to return back to a normal of some sort, right? Mm-hmm. Like even though we're always still going to have COVID in the back of our minds, it's reminding ourselves that like we can slow down sometimes, or like to examine other parts of like what's going on in our life rather than just like the daily schedule. I mean, I'm just talking to myself.
No. This is well put. Totally. I totally agree. Well, it was interesting too, just because going off of what you were saying, it's like, yeah, just like coming out of COVID, a lot of us had a time to stop and be a little quieter with ourselves. And it's kind of a good reminder to folks that art is designed to give us that also, so that like when life starts to feel so busy, like that is kind of like the perfect time to like take in a concert or like go to a museum, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Or go on a walk, even.
Go on a walk. Get outside.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think there's been a couple articles recently or Canada has like now allowed doctors to prescribe to the patients who are experiencing anxiety or other levels of mental health issues free passes to their national park system.
Wow.
With the idea
I love that forever.
I know, that's right? I know.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Because there's been some studies that have come out, and I don't remember which studies are aware, but there's been some studies that have come up that said by going on a hike or going on certain nature walks that alleviates some of these mental anxieties or depressions or things that we on a day-to-day basis have to worry about, right? And it's like, it's such a Canadian thing, but also like, why don't we do that? You know, why can't doctors prescribe that?
Well, I have this funny warm fuzzy feeling when like science like figures out something that everybody already knows. You know? It's like new study, like chocolate tastes good.
Right, exactly. Yeah, when you start like zeroing in too far, that's like, as you say, it's like a good opportunity to remind yourself of the polar opposite of zenning out and going on a hike. Are there any last thoughts that you would want to share about your experiences backpacking with listeners on this podcast?
No, I don't want to be your dad, but it's good to make a plan and be safe.
emergency contact.
If you're using a phone, like offline that GPS so that like when you lose signal, which you will, you can see where you are. It's great. Bring a spare battery even. Enjoy.
Yeah, awesome. Can I ask you two final questions?
Sure.
What is one piece of advice you would tell your younger self about entering and pursuing a music career?
for my younger self in particular, who I love that guy, but he's definitely an overthinker. I would say just like take a look at what's right in front of your face and like take a breath and keep walking and keep doing the thing. So like this is sort of the antidote to analysis paralysis. Like this is the antidote to like there's a million paths in front of me. And it's like I would tell him that like keep on walking down that path that you're already on and without as much second guessing and like getting tied up in a knot about like if I make this decision now, like does it set my next 40 years on the wrong track or something? Because I don't think that's actually how life works.
But it feels like that way when you're young.
But it totally can feel like that when you're younger.
And my second question, how has the pandemic changed your career?
Well, not that my exploits today would bear it out at all, but I did have fun tinkering around with some audio engineering stuff.
Well, just for listeners, so, we've had a couple little blips here and there in the recording process. Hopefully you can't notice, but...
No, you'll be great on the listening end. It's all been great on Patty's end, for the record. But yeah, I have thought it was fun to like tinker with gadgets like ever since I was younger. So this gave like a fun outlet to it at a time when like the only way to perform was to like make some kind of little homemade setup for yourself. So I'm talking to you for this podcast on like a guitar center mic and audio interface that I bought when it was like, all right, we got to do Zoom concerts. We got to do YouTubes. Here we go. So yeah, I think it gave us a lot, it gave us a lot of a chance to explore a field or a hobby or whatever it was that we wouldn't have gotten into otherwise. And
yeah, that's a good answer.
This is sort of mine. Yeah.
Nice. Are there any platforms, websites, places for people to learn more about you?
Sure. Go head on over to jamesjaffeycello.com. And that's where I usually pretty decent about posting at least what the upcoming performances are under events. And on the homepage, you can also, you know, I keep a little mailing list going. I'll send you very infrequent little notes about what I'm up to. Oh, yeah. Other than that, you can just check out projects I'm in. There's Wave Chamber Collective. There's One Found Sound. There's Festival Roland. And there's Trinity Alps Chamber Music Festival.
Thank you so much, James, for joining me on the podcast today. As I said, it's been too long, so I'm giving you a hug from afar.
Oh, thanks, Patty. It's so cool to see you again,
too. Yeah, it's like nothing's changed.
Right. I know. We need to go get another burrito and take a walk.
Absolutely. I'd 100% do that with you. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, and thanks for listening. Say bye, sushi.